Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, and I'm super excited to have Vijay Boyapati back on the show. But before we get into this awesome chat, a quick word from our sponsors. Huge congratulations to Ledin on announcing their impending launch of a Bitcoin-backed mortgage product, the first product of its kind to hit the market. This mortgage will enable Ledin clients to use their Bitcoin holdings to purchase a property while continuing to benefit from potential price appreciation of both assets. In pilot mode, the Ledin Bitcoin-backed mortgage is slated to be made broadly available to clients in the U.S. and Canada in early 2022. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast can get a free $50 in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. To learn more, sign up at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Bitcoin 2022 will be held on Miami Beach from April 6th to April 9th, and you can use code Bitcoin Matrix at checkout to get a 10% discount. All tickets are transferable and 100% refundable if you're unable to travel due to COVID restrictions. Going to the Bitcoin conference will change your life. It's an investment in yourself, and it will help you stack more sats if you do it right. So if you haven't secured tickets for next April, go and do it now at b.tc/conference. Remember to use the code Bitcoin Matrix for 10% off. And now let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Vijay in what I promise you will be a very fascinating discussion on Bitcoin cycles, the Fermi paradox, and the great filter.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Born and raised in Australia, Vijay Boyapati moved to the United States in 2000 to pursue a PhD in computer science. Instead of enrolling in a doctoral program, Vijay ended up at a small startup called Google, where he spent several years using his background in machine learning to improve the ranking algorithms used in Google News. Boyapati left his lucrative job in 2007 to work on a grassroots campaign in the 2008 presidential election, helping to raise millions of dollars and bring hundreds of volunteers to New Hampshire to canvass for Ron Paul. In 2011, Vijay discovered Bitcoin and went down the proverbial rabbit hole in a quest to understand how a new form of internet money backed by no commodity and guaranteed by no government could have any economic value. Armed with a background in Austrian economics, Vijay wrote the book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, to provide the layperson with an economic framework with which they could understand Bitcoin. Vijay, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Cedric.
Yeah, man. I'm super excited to reconnect. Part of the impetus for this conversation was what we kind of touched upon a little bit in our last chat. And before we kind of get into sort of pessimism or optimism, maybe for the future and sort of humanity long term, I'm kind of curious, you know, one, what has been the reaction like to the book? I mean, it's almost been, what, almost a year since it's been out? Maybe about 8-9 months?
Yeah, actually, it's about 6 months. It launched on Kickstarter, right. I guess in about June, and it's been doing great. It sold $150,000 worth just on Kickstarter. Since it's launched on Amazon, there's been a lot of demand. People are reaching out directly to buy like packs of books to give away to friends. So it's been going as well as I could have hoped for. You know, actually, I'm absolutely over the moon. I would have been happy if I had sold $10,000 worth of books. So this is like so far and above what I expected. And I'm just really humble and have a lot of humility about like people willing to support me. It's great. I feel like there's just so much support in the Bitcoin community for people like me who are trying to educate and provide resources for education for people who are just coming into the space. So I'm really grateful to everyone who, you know, supported me in the launch of the book, including you. It's been doing great.
Yeah, I love the book. I love how it really expands a lot on the prior article. And one of my favorite parts in the book is when you examine cycles in technology, cycles in sort of humanity, but also in Bitcoin. And this has been a really interesting year. 2021, we think of sort of, 2021 and Bitcoin in 2017 or 2013. And this cycle seems to be playing out very differently, which I think is nice. Like history kind of, doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think it would be kind of like a little silly to just expect it to play out exactly the same. But one of my questions for you where we are right now is, do you think we've reached all the people that are reachable in this cycle?
I think it's fairly unlikely. The interesting thing about these cycles is, just from the perspective of a student of economics, we have never seen the monetization of an economic good in real time. And so we're learning that what the process even looks like. And it just happens to happen in these cycles. We've learned that with Bitcoin, the monetization happens in these approximately 4-year cycles. And they looked fairly similar. They look like a fractal pattern of increasing magnitude. So you look at the graph of the bull market of 2017 and you superimpose it on 2013. They look fairly similar, not identical, but similar enough that you could say it's a fractal pattern. And so I think a lot of people were assuming that this bull market would just be very similar to 2017. It would follow the same pattern, but it hasn't. We've definitely had at least... We don't know whether the bull market's over or not, but we at least had a mini bear market during the bull market where Bitcoin got all the way up to, I think, 65,000, and then it crashed all the way down to 29,000 and then recovered all the way back to 69,000 and then has retreated back to about 49,000. So it definitely does not look like prior cycles. One of the signals that we got in prior cycles that the cycle was about to end was you'd get a kind of madness of crowds phenomena where people would just pile in because they were just they were motivated by just speculative profit taking and profit making and coming in and trying to make profits really quickly. Like I want to buy Bitcoin or I want to buy some altcoin so I can make 50% in like 3 days. And you just get this flood of money coming in. We haven't seen anything like that. And that speculative fervor is usually accompanied by a kind of breakdown in the financial system, the Bitcoin ecosystem, where you have exchanges going down because they can't handle the volume. You have very large inter-exchange spreads where you'll see, a price on Coinbase and like 10% or plus minus percent at Binance, for instance, which tells you that there are some very large inefficiencies in the market and money isn't moving around freely. The system itself is under a lot of stress. We haven't seen anything like that. And those are usually have been good signs that we're near the end of the cycle. So the fact that we haven't seen that makes me think it's unlikely we've seen the end of the cycle. We haven't seen that crazy speculative fervor where Bitcoin is written about on the cover of every financial magazine or newspaper on earth, and people are just falling all over themselves to try to get into the market and get that last bit of profit that they think is going to be really easy to get. So yeah, I don't know. I again, going back to being a student of economics, we're learning something here. Maybe Bitcoin has reached such a scale that the cycles that we've seen in the past can't be expected in the future. Maybe the cycles have become so elongated, they're becoming longer and longer. Maybe they're getting to the length where they just sort of get you to the next halving. And that halving sort of keeps Bitcoin going and the cycle gets longer and longer. And so maybe it won't be a cycle in the traditional sense where you have a massive crash. It'll be Bitcoin kind of floating around this price level somewhere between, say, $50,000 and $100,000 for the next few years. And then the next halving pushes us through $100,000 and gets us to the next level. But it happens in a slow and gradual process. We don't know. It's an open question. And I think it's absolutely fascinating to just observe the market and see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But if you were to ask me to bet on this, I would say that it's likely this cycle will still look similar to 2017, that the speculative fervor is still at some point in the future. We just haven't seen it. I think it's unlikely that this is the cycle where we've kind of detached and we're no longer going to do what we've done in the past. So my bias is to believe that the end of the cycle hasn't come, and we'll see it maybe in 6 months, maybe in a year from now.
Right. I wonder then, I mean, is it possible? I like what you said there around kind of ranging into the next halving. And what I'm kind of seeing now, or, you know, maybe the cycle is getting longer and that we're grinding up more slowly. So maybe over the summer, we spent 3 to 6 months ranging between 30 and 40,000. Now we're going to spend maybe 3 to 6 months going between 40 and 50,000. And that's sort of like just a more healthy way to grind up and setting a more solid floor at each level. But then I wonder, though, if we do grind our way to the next halving, is that the end of cycles, maybe, in sort of the way we're referring to them and these sort of these four-year cycles, maybe driven, maybe the halvings are more of like, in some way, like in people's minds now, priced in and more of a gradual progression, whereas, you know, I know it goes every 4 years right away, the halving's cut in half, maybe people are sort of pricing that in and we're going to just, do you think there's a possibility we have no more cycles?
I think one thing that has changed is the market's treatment of Bitcoin as an investment or a savings vehicle has changed somewhat. I think in, 2013 or 2017, it was more speculative in a way. People hadn't sort of come around to the idea that Bitcoin is this great new form of savings and that they just periodically put a part of their paycheck in it. And you see that both at the micro scale with individuals taking, say, 5, 10, or some people putting 100% of their paycheck into Bitcoin, but they're doing it on a continual basis. So you have this constant inflow of money. And you see that on the sort of larger macro scale as well, where you have corporations or people like Michael Saylor, who's running MicroStrategy. They're just taking all of their earnings, all of their profits, right, and dumping it into Bitcoin. They're using it as a savings vehicle as well. And so what you have is this constant source of demand where it wasn't kind of this back and forth battle between bulls and bears, just buying and selling large chunks, but you never really know who is like holding for the long term. Whereas now I think people are saying, this is a great vehicle for savings. I'm just going to keep accumulating it over time. So the flow of dollars into the Bitcoin market, I think, is there's a big chunk of it which is fairly consistent and can be relied upon, rather than like big flows coming in and then disappearing and coming back in. I think that's really changed the nature of the market quite significantly. I know lots of people who dollar cost average into Bitcoin no matter what. Now we have services which cater to doing just that. So Swan Bitcoin, River Financial, and numerous countries have equivalent services where people just say, just deduct from my checking account every month this amount of dollars. And so what happens is when you get to the next halving, so that's constant demand, right, coming from these people who are putting a fixed dollar amount into Bitcoin. On the sell side, you have constant supply coming onto the market because of miners. Miners are forced to sell to cover the cost of electricity. Right. And what you have at the halving is the sell pressure gets halved in magnitude. And if you have a constant source of demand where people are just putting, the same amount of dollars in every month, then at the halving, you get an excess of demand over supply. And that's what tends to trigger the price moving upwards or gradually going upwards. But the fact that we have this constant source of demand, I think maybe one of the factors which we could say has changed the nature of the market enough that we're going to see a smooth progression. The counter argument I would give, though, is that if we see a smooth progression up, that attracts speculators. And it's very hard for speculators to see something that's drifting up slowly and think, well, I want to get some of that. And then eventually you get more and more people piling in, it goes parabolic. So again, my bias is that we will see that eventually, and it will be triggered by the fact that we have this strong base of sort of unchanging demand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that really kind of puts some perspective on the economic framing of it right now. And I'm kind of curious what you think about, you know, do Bitcoiners have a place in Washington? You know, does it make sense to have like to strive for an orange party, or are Bitcoiners like a single issue voting bloc?
I think that's actually very unlikely that Bitcoin is a single issue voting bloc. I think the range of distribution of political opinions amongst Bitcoiners is very, very wide. You have people who are very, very conservative, anti-government, and then you also have people who are very, very liberal. You also famously have someone like Alex Gladstein, who you know you'd expect comes from the political left, who works at the Human Rights Foundation. And there are numerous people like Nick Szabo who are very conservative, who are also very pro-Bitcoin. So it seems unlikely to me that you'd get those people coming together, but that doesn't mean that people won't care enough about Bitcoin to vote on it, especially if it affects their pocketbook. If you have people who have a significant amount of savings in Bitcoin and politicians come along and propose policies that are very harmful to those savings, you could easily see that become a big enough issue. Just like if a politician came along and said, I'm going to take 10% of your 401k every year because we need to cover the deficit, that would likely be a big political issue for both Democrats and Republicans, because they both have 401ks, they both have retirement plans, and they would both be very upset if those retirement plans were attacked in that way. So I don't expect a party, a Bitcoin party. And it's also because in the US, the party system has been so kind of rigged that there really isn't space for a third party. The way it's being constructed is you can only really have two parties in the United States. It's not like a Westminster system like they have in England and Australia and Canada, where it's designed specifically so that you have a lot of minority parties. The US system really has a very strong tendency for there to be only two parties. It's very, very difficult, for instance, if you create a third party to get into the presidential debates. So it's very hard to get any exposure. But the qualifying bar to get into the presidential debate is extremely high. So it's been very, very rare historically that third parties have been created. And it's usually only because someone was incredibly wealthy that they could pay to get themselves into the debate. Someone like thinking of the debate in the 90s between Clinton and was it Bob Dole?
That sounds about
right. I've forgotten who the third person was.
Oh, Ross Perot?
Ross Perot, there you go. He was just a very rich person who managed to get himself into the debates because he wasn't a Democrat or a Republican, but he could get enough publicity just through his own money. And generally, people who are really rich don't want to do that.
Right.
So I think it's very unlikely we're going to have a third party.
Yeah, definitely in terms of third party. I'm thinking a little bit more in terms of lobbying and policymaking. And so recently, like C.J. Wilson and Alex Gladstein went to D.C., did some lobbying. And one of the points C.J. brought up in terms of educating politicians and lobbying on behalf or, you know, sort of Bitcoin issues is that, you know, it's probably more effective to lobby 400 or 500 politicians than maybe canvassing door to door to 2 million Americans to raise awareness around Bitcoin. And so I'm kind of wondering.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but I struggle where I've never really seen an issue, you know, at a really large level, like say at the federal level, like marijuana, where you see state level consensus across 47, 48 states that have made it medical or recreational, but it hasn't changed anything at the federal level. So I really struggle with, I don't see myself wanting to put a lot of time into those issues. And I wonder how much effect maybe lobbying can have in DC. And I'm wondering what you think about that, sort of that, like, do we, you know, sort of go door to door, or not that anyone's going door to door, but you know what I mean? Is it effective maybe to educate politicians?
I think it can be very effective, especially when politicians see that there are there's a group of people who are very motivated. So, you know, they recently tried to pass the infrastructure bill, which had some language about cryptocurrency exchanges and how they should be regulated. And they got so much pushback that I think they didn't expect would come from like a relatively minor part of the infrastructure bill, that they realized, well, that there is a very strong interest group out there that cares a lot about Bitcoin and cares about this industry not being destroyed. So I think that kind of lobbying can be effective, and you kind of have to show politicians that there's a demographic out there that can be swung, because really politicians don't care about the extremes of the two parties. They don't care about the Democrats who are always going to vote Democrat regardless. They don't care about the Republicans who are always going to vote Republican. They care about the people who potentially could swing their vote. And so what you need to do as a lobbyist is you need to explain to them, this is a swing vote. These are people who could potentially change their vote if you appeal to them on this particular issue. And I do think there are quite a lot of Bitcoiners who could be appealed to and who care passionately or deeply enough about Bitcoin that if a politician came out and said, I'm very pro Bitcoin and I want to advance this new technology and make it, you know, regulations friendly so that Bitcoin can thrive in the United States and we can become a center for Bitcoin innovation, then I think there is the possibility for them to get a lot of votes. And I see people like Cynthia Lummis. Ted Cruz has shown that he has a pretty deep understanding. There's a handful of people in the House as well. So I think that, you know, people are starting to realize there's an opportunity here to get some votes. And I think the traditional method of lobbying could be effective. It definitely could be people like Alex going out on the Hill and explaining why Bitcoin will get you more votes and why the narrative around Bitcoin is actually very positive. It's good for the world and it's good for America. I think that could be effective, yeah.
Yeah. I think Alex is a really interesting voice in the space. And I think, not that he's underheard, he's got a lot of followers on Twitter and he's well-known, but I think he could be a bridge in the way that like Michael Saylor was on Tucker Carlson. And I think a lot of people are starting maybe to think about or little feelings about partisan about Bitcoin with maybe Ted Cruz or Tucker Carlson. And I think Alex could maybe reach a lot of sort of and bridge that partisan divide. I think that's also part of the struggle as a Bitcoiner is like you try to think of it as maybe trying to be apolitical, or I speak for myself. I try to be a little bit more apolitical now and look at things out just as issues and where I feel about a particular issue. And I think more of the country actually resides in the middle. So I think Alex is a very interesting voice there. And I think that kind of speaks a lot to sort of that we talked a little bit about the near term and with economics and where we are in the cycle and a little bit with politics. And I see that as sort of the medium term, but I would like to kind of turn towards, more long-term thinking. We got into a little bit of back and forth in our last chat, and I had mentioned that, you know, growing up, and I don't know if I was, I might have been, I think you took us in a little different direction, but I said all the world's problems have been solved. And I meant more like in line with like my problems have been solved. So, you know, there's a microwave in the kitchen and I could just make food for myself. I'm 8 years old, you know, and Nintendo's coming out and things are changing drastically from where my parents were, you know, had maybe an ice box, you know, and they didn't have a microwave and they didn't have a Nintendo and they didn't have America Online and the internet. And it just seemed like everything was here and everything was coming. It was very positive and, you know, but I did study things like the Holocaust and sort of World War II. And, you know, and I was sort of, I don't think the word was trained, but I was kind of like looking for when history would rhyme or feel like it's repeating itself. And what would those flags look like? And so now I fast forward, I do think we're kind of in sort of interesting times, I'll put it that way. But you had mentioned that you were sort of in our conversation at the moment, a little bit pessimistic or very pessimistic. I shouldn't say a little, very, I'd like to speak for you, but sort of pessimistic about the challenges facing humanity more longer term. And so I'm kind of curious, maybe, you know, what kind of asymmetries are you concerned about long term?
Yeah, so this is a big topic, and I'm excited to talk to you about it because it's something I've thought about for a very, very long time. I haven't talked to anyone about it. So as I mentioned before the show, I hope I can come across as coherent and why I find this really interesting. I like to think very, very long term. I'm not talking sort of in the time span of like even a few centuries or millennia. I'm talking about like the human species and whether we're going to make it or not, which I find an absolutely fascinating question. I think this is getting a little bit more play now because of someone like Elon Musk, who's talking about he's dreaming very big. He's thinking about humans being multiplanetary, which I think is a great thing that someone is actually beginning to think about that. But since I was a young kid, I've been really interested in this question of, are we going to reach the stars? Is humanity going to reach the stars? Are we going to colonize the solar system? Are we going to colonize the galaxy? And this is like a multi-millennia type project. And one of the questions that comes up when you start thinking about this is this possible? And if it is possible, why haven't we really seen it? Like, the universe is absolutely massive. There's 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, and there are 100 billion galaxies. So it's very hard for the human mind to reason about that, but there's a lot. The universe is huge. And we've, fairly recently discovered that many of these stars have planets around them. Most of them are fairly big planets because we detect them through their gravitational effect on these stars. But we have discovered smaller ones, and we can believe with some high probability there are a lot of planets out there in these hundreds of billions of stars, and probably a lot of planets that resemble our own planet. So the question is, why don't we see evidence of civilization? And this gets to this very, very big question in science. It's called the Fermi paradox. And the Fermi paradox goes something like this: despite the size and the scale of the universe, why haven't we detected any signs of civilization? And one of the most compelling explanations given, I think, for the Fermi paradox is this idea of the great filter. Mm-hmm. And the great filter is this idea that there's some occurrence which makes it exceedingly unlikely for the development of a spacefaring civilization that would give you sort of outward signs that it exists. And the thing about the great filter is, the great filter could be before us, before our time of humans on Earth, or it could be after us. And that's a very, very important question. Is it before us or is it after us? If it was before us, then, we can be somewhat optimistic that, we're not going to be completely wiped out. If the great filter is after us, then something may be coming down in the future which will make it unlikely that we're even going to survive. What would the great filter before us look like? It would be something like, well, on Earth, it took hundreds of millions of years, perhaps a billion years, before any life showed up. So this is a very, very long period of time where different molecules were sloshing around on Earth in kind of different environments before it somehow came together in some very special, peculiar circumstance that life was created. So that may be just exceedingly improbable. It may be far less probable than the fact than the number of stars in the universe. So it may just be that, life happening is exceedingly unlikely. And also, from the moment that life was created in the sense that we could recognize a very simple cell, to go from that simple cell to something which is, just slightly more complex, multi-cell organism, that took 2 billion years. And you could imagine at any point that maybe life was wiped out for some reason in that period, 2 billion years before life became just a tiny bit more complex. And it's interesting because about a decade ago, we had a Mars lander land on Mars and do a bunch of, scientific experiments. And people were really excited because they were like, oh, we might find signs of life on Mars. And that would be really exciting because there's water on Mars in the past. And if we, go and probe the water, maybe we'll see some organism on there, Martian life, which is distinct from Earthwife. And there was a very interesting article in the MIT Review around that time, which said it would be really bad if we found life on Mars, because what that would mean is that the great filter wasn't in our past. The reason why we don't see space-faring civilizations isn't because of our past. Seeing life on another planet would say that life would probably be everywhere. It would have been developed everywhere. And the fact that we don't see space-faring civilizations would mean the great filter is in our future. What would the great filter look like if it was in our future? It could be that there's some inherent process to the development of civilization and the development of technology that gives us so much power that it's just inevitable that we're going to destroy ourselves. And that is a question that has really, I've been obsessing over for pretty much as long as I've been obsessing about Bitcoin. So that's the part I want to talk about a little bit, and why I feel somewhat pessimistic about the future of humanity. One thing I think is really important about human societies is the idea of asymmetry, and that human societies are largely dictated, the shape of human societies are dictated by the asymmetries that are available to us in society. Human nature itself doesn't change, or it hasn't changed for a very, very long time. It's largely static. But there are very different technological and scientific and environmental factors in each different epoch in human history. And it's those factors which determine what direction human society will go in. So for instance, the printing press was a huge change to human reality, or the development, for instance, of the wheel, mm-hmm. or the bow and arrow. Right. So in terms of asymmetries, if you go back in history, one of the first asymmetries, these asymmetries, a lot of them have to do with people's relation to other people in terms of control. One of the first asymmetries which was developed was the bow and arrow, which gives a single person the ability to harm or kill other people at distance, and, you know, harm or kill multiple people at distance. So that's an offensive asymmetry, that a technology which gives an asymmetry to an individual to do more damage than they would be able to do just with their fists alone. Right. A defensive asymmetry historically was the development of the castle. And the castle, what it did was it would give an individual or a family the ability to protect their resources from a very large number of people. And actually, if you look at British history, it changed very dramatically when the Normans invaded Britain and put castles all over Britain. Before the Norman invasion in 1066, England had very few castles. And then the Normans came in and they brought this innovation from Europe, which is the development of castles. And it allowed this very small minority of Normans, who were basically French-speaking people, to come into England and conquer England and hold on to England, because they just sort of sat in their castles. And the native population, which was far, far larger than the invaders, was not able to attack these defensive fortifications. So that's another kind of asymmetry. It's a defensive asymmetry. Tying this kind of a little bit to Bitcoin, I think Bitcoin is something that provides a defensive asymmetry, because it allows the individual a huge amount of power to defend their own wealth against much more powerful institutions like the state, which have, you know, bombs and tanks and that sort of thing. And in modern times, probably the most significant offensive asymmetry that's been created is the nuclear bomb. The ability to destroy entire cities in an instant has created a massive offensive asymmetry. Now, why do these asymmetries matter? They matter because in any human society, you have a large distribution of social dispositions. You have people who are right in the middle of the spectrum on the bell curve, who are very normal, right? They operate in society and they get along very easily. And just, you'd recognize them as a regular, normal person. But at the extremes of the social distribution, you have sociopaths, people who are socially very pathological and who want to harm humanity just for the sake of harming humanity. And you've seen people who have gone on, you know, mass shooting rampages. And we now live in an era due to offensive asymmetries that have been created where people who are socially pathological can do massive damage to society. And you can think of examples of people going into a crowd, a single person going to a crowd and very quickly killing scores and scores of people. That would have been very, very difficult a few thousand years ago because they just didn't have the technology to be able to do that. And what I worry about is that these asymmetries are becoming bigger and becoming more available and cheaper and available to people who are at the extremes of the social distribution, which also, you know, I think it's worth noting, why do we have this wired distribution of social dispositions in the human species, or actually any species? The reason we have it is it makes us at a species level more adaptable to changes in nature. Yeah. If our social environment or the environment itself, changes, then if it's kind of an event that could cause a potential extinction in our species, we have enough of a distribution that some of our distribution will survive and they will breed and they will become kind of the center of the distribution, the fat part of the bell curve. There is a benefit from a species level to having this wide sort of distribution and having these extremes. The danger comes when a species has asymmetric power, because then the extremes of the distribution can do enough harm to the rest of the species to essentially wipe the species out. And there was a thought experiment that I thought of, you know, many, many years ago, probably two or three decades ago, which I think kind of illustrates this. What would human society look like if you could construct a nuclear weapon with common, cheaply available and widely available household items? What would human society look like? We would likely not exist, because there would be some tiny fraction of the human population who are just so pathological, who would use the ability to create nuclear weapons to destroy all of us. And it just happens that nuclear weapons are expensive enough and require enough centralization of power and resources that the sociopaths aren't able to corral those resources to make something like that happen. And as harmful as nation states can be, the people who control the nuclear weapons right now are fairly rational. They realize the damage that would happen if they used a nuclear weapon and it would be mutually assured destruction, so they don't do it. But a sociopath doesn't have any of those concerns. A person at the extremes of the social distribution doesn't care about that. And I think we are actually coming to the point where we now have technologies that are available at the individual level where individuals can do gigantic asymmetric damage. And I really am very concerned about what effect this is going to have on society. I think if you go back to my thought experiment about the nuclear weapon, if that was possible, what would happen is we would live in the most intrusive surveillance society you could ever imagine. Everyone would have a device attached to them at all times, saying exactly what they were doing, whether they were buying the components or assembling the components to, you know, create one of these nuclear devices. And we would be watched at all times. And it would be, you know, it would make, you know, Nazi Germany seem like a fun playground compared to what that would be. It would be so incredibly intrusive, and everyone would tolerate it and accept it, because the alternative would be the complete annihilation of the human species. So I'm concerned that we're hurtling towards this future where these kind of technologies are being developed. And I'll give you a very simple example of something that has been developed, which is drones that can carry munitions. The quality of drones right now is so high that anyone can buy a drone that can pilot itself to wherever you want it to go. And they're capable of carrying enough munitions. You could imagine someone who is moderately wealthy buying, you know, a handful of these things and doing huge damage with this, what kind of effect would that have on the psychology of populations and what they would be willing to tolerate? What kind of oppressive authoritarian regime would they be willing to tolerate to make sure something like that didn't happen? I think we are on the cusp technologically of getting to a place where people at the extremes of the social distribution will be able to do asymmetric damage. And I don't know how human society is going to be able to handle that. That concerns me a lot. On the positive side, I think there are asymmetries like Bitcoin, for instance, which give me a lot of hope because they provide an even greater foundation for human civilization, which is capital formation and saving and innovation and all of those things. But I also worry about the other side of things. So anyway, that's a kind of long description of something I've been thinking about for a long time and why I feel somewhat pessimistic about the future. I worry about the future and I worry about the kind of inevitability of technological development, that people develop things sometimes without sort of stepping back and saying, what is the consequence here of us doing this? I think there was kind of an inevitability of the development of the nuclear bomb because of World War II. The people who are doing it, I don't think enough of them stepped back and said, what is the consequence for the world that we have nuclear technology? Is it good or is it bad? It certainly puts us at massive risk because we have the capacity already with the technology we already had and which we've had since the 40s to destroy the whole world. We have enough explosive capacity that we could kill every human being on Earth 100 times over. And this used to be a much bigger concern in the 50s and 60s. People were really worried this would happen. They were worried that there'd be a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. But it's kind of faded out of interest for, you know, modern society, and millennials don't even think about it at all. They don't get these drills where they're at school where they're supposed to hide under the table like they had in the 60s. But this is just as big a threat as it has ever been, a nuclear disaster. So these are things which give me pause, and I hope that other people will think about this and reason about this and how we can find a way that the great filter, going back to the Fermi paradox, the great filter is not in our future. I really hope it's not in our future. And I really hope that eventually the human species becomes multiplanetary, just like Elon Musk is talking about, because that greatly increases the probability of our long-term survival. If we have some huge disaster on Earth, there'll at least be humans who can continue on and spread out and colonize the rest of the galaxy.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really fascinating what you shared there, and a lot to unpack. When I first heard the great filter, I think of it as in front of us. That's just kind of how I interpreted it. That was kind of my gut instinct. I saw that as sort of optimistic, that we had my sort of signs of optimism that we haven't seen life anywhere else. Therefore, you know, no one's really gone through this, or because I do think if we saw signs of life, specifically if life visited us, I think we'd be in great peril, maybe. If they've mastered the technology to visit us before we've kind of mastered maybe defensive technology against that or asymmetries. What I never heard, though, is sort of my pessimism for the great filter was always around centralized power, around either nuclear energy in centralized hands at the nation state level, or some sort of centralized issue around maybe artificial intelligence or machine learning. I never heard really around like distributed nuclear power or distributed asymmetries that would destroy the whole world. You know, I thought about sociopaths maybe in sort of centralized positions of great power, not sort of on the fringe. I thought that was really interesting. And I guess you see the great filter, you're hoping or optimistic maybe because you think the great filter might be behind us. Is that sort of your impression?
I hope so. If it were the case that the great filter was behind us, the implications would be we are the only intelligent species in the universe, and it is for us to go out and colonize the universe. There's no one else out there. It's for us to go out and understand the universe and get ourselves on other planets. That is really a multi-millennia project, because there are so many things that make it incredibly difficult for us to even get to Mars. Just the very fact that we have evolved over millions of years to live on Earth, our bodies are not physically made to live on another planet. And it's not just like the fact that, you know, isn't food. It's the oxygen level, the thinness of the atmosphere, the lack of gravity, the fact that if you go out into space, your muscles and your bones atrophy very quickly over time. There are huge problems to even visiting Mars. So the idea of actually getting humanity a colony on a place like Mars will take a massive amount of effort and a massive amount of capital accumulation. So it is really something that as a species, we need to be thinking in terms of, you know, hundreds of generations, how are we going to do this? And very few people have given any thought to this. This is why one of the reasons, you know, there's some things I don't like about Elon Musk, but this is one of the reasons I'm a huge fan of his, is that he is really thinking big. And it's important that someone thinks that big and thinks about the idea of giving humanity a chance in the very long term.
Yeah. I mean, Elon also mentioned it's possible that maybe we've gone through these iterations before and gone or, you know, failed going through the great filter already. And that it keeps popping up in front of us as a species or humanity. And that could be playing out over billions of years. I've always kind of seen it as in front of us. And I think that kind of, I think that the power that we're going to have to harness to get through the great filter is the same power in a sort of paradox that's going to destroy us or threaten to destroy us. But a lot of what the technologies you were talking about that are asymmetrical are here now, like we were talking about with the drones. We're talking about this.
We haven't seen their worst use.
Sure.
We haven't seen their worst use yet.
Yeah. And so I wonder, like, on that level, like, are you pessimistic in the short term around these technologies and how they could change humanity and the way they could drive power into fewer and fewer hands? And, you know, the questions you were asking is like, what compromises do we make to, in that instance, of distributed nuclear technology, sort of the way you see distributed power with like 3D printing and guns? You know, that we're going to have to, what compromise are we going to have to make to defend ourselves against ourselves?
It is something that gives me great concern, even in the short term. And I remember seeing a tweet, someone showed a picture and it was some military that was boasting about how it had attached a munition to a drone and how this was the future of warfare. And I think I replied at the time, no, this is the end of the human species. This is something that we should all be very, very concerned about, getting into the hands of the population at large. If this technology becomes so cheap and so widely available that anyone can do it, and they can deploy something very, very harmful that can hurt a lot of people very quickly, then the character of our society will change. And we will, I think, fall in on ourselves society will become a much more vicious place, because people will be so distrustful of each other and will crave security so much. Even actually, you know, during this pandemic, one thing I've realized is how easy it is to change public will, the public opinion, how easy it is to shape public opinion on something where just a few years ago, some of the things that are happening today would have sounded absolutely insane and conspiratorial, like just gigantic parts of the population losing their employment because they don't want to get a vaccination. Now, I think that's absolutely crazy. I don't want to sound like someone who's an anti-vaxxer, because I think there's actually very useful technology in the development of these mRNA vaccines. But the fact that society itself could be manipulated into applying such authoritarian force on a group of people who don't want to get vaccinated, I think is absolutely appalling. It really bodes very poorly for the future if something even scarier than COVID comes along, because, you know, COVID has killed, you know, a large number of people, but as far as like a pandemic goes, it's fairly mild. It is nothing compared to the Spanish flu in 1918 or the bubonic plague. It's nothing like that. So I think, like, if something that was actually really, really deadly came along, what would human society look like? It would be very, very scary, I think. So there are a number of different ways where you could get to a very authoritarian world, because public opinion can be shifted very, very quickly.
Yeah, I fear more the authoritarian world in terms of our long-term progress, in terms of getting through the great filter, because I just don't see that sort of centralization of power leading to anything like, you know, or any moonshots or anything. It doesn't seem advantageous to the ruling class to do that. But just, you know, in terms of like maybe something like aliens or something, like, I don't know what that means, but just mathematically, I think that life outside of this planet would exist. And I wonder, like, on that front, like, whether they've had then a head start, whether they've been around longer and gotten further than us, or maybe they started after us, and maybe for some reason they've gotten further than us. And if another life form had the ability to do multi-planetary travel, maybe they wouldn't necessarily tip their hand or let us know, you know. And it's even possible, I think, that they would seed our demise maybe in a non-physical way. So, you know,
that's a very interesting point. I think it's something that we can't really know, whether the great filter is behind us or ahead of us. Some people have very strong beliefs on this, and they think, well, obviously, because there's a lot of stars, and a great fraction of those stars have planets like ours, that really the filter must be ahead of us. There must be life all over the place. But I'm not convinced of that. I think if we had found life on Mars, that would have been a tremendous, it would have been tremendously interesting in answering that questions. It would have been definitive and said that if life can develop on two planets, then probably it's developed everywhere. But that wasn't the case. We haven't found any evidence of life on Mars. But the depressing thing, if we did find life on Mars, then we would know that the great filter, and the reason we don't see evidence of civilization, is because there's probably a great filter in the future. And I imagine that the same, I talked about the distribution of social dispositions in our species and the distribution in other species. I think that would apply to every planet. I think that any species that develops anywhere in the universe has to have a wide distribution to be able to handle changes in the natural environment of the planet. Otherwise, if you had a very small, narrow distribution of the kind of changes in a species, if you had any kind of environmental change, the entire species would be wiped out. So the fact that you have, I think really what my belief is, it fundamentally comes down to the fact that you need this wide distribution to have evolution and to survive changing environment. But as a species becomes technologically more powerful, the presence of that distribution is what makes it more likely that the species will destroy itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot to kind of manage or handle there. I'm kind of curious, you know, if the great filter is in front of us, what are your thoughts maybe on artificial intelligence? Is this something that, like, we're going to kind of get our hands around and really create? Is it, or is it not much more than machine learning and sort of algorithmic programming? Is this something that's very far off? Is this something that's going to bring benefits and maybe be needed to get through the great filter?
Yeah, my background is actually in machine learning. I'm very, very skeptical of artificial intelligence. I think most of it comes down to, if you really look under the hood, it's just sort of mathematical optimization. Mm-hmm. And you can create models which are optimized to do certain things very well. And it can look kind of like intelligence. You can get a computer highly optimized to play chess. And you know, that might, mm-hmm. you know, from a distance look like that's an intelligent thing, but no, it's really a program that's parameters have been really optimized to do that particular thing really well. I don't think we've seen any evidence of any kind of sentience or anything even remotely resembling that to think we've made any breakthrough. I don't think we even understand our own sentience yet. And I think that's still one of the big philosophical questions. Also, you know, that gets down to things like determinism or free will. Like, do we actually have free will? Are we thinking, and do we have control over what's going to happen in the future? Or is the future essentially predetermined based on our genetic predisposition? These are questions which are still completely open, and no one really has good answers for any of these things. So I think at this stage, I think it's probably better to be skeptical of artificial intelligence until there's some even minor breakthrough where we can say, okay, we recognize now there is some potential for sentience. That is not what we've seen. We've just seen computer programs optimized to do things like computer vision and chess.
Yeah. What I thought was really interesting was something like chess or even games like Go, where with machine learning, the computer even took chances or did things that were sort of outside the box or against sort of the rule of thumb for that game, and discovered new routes to sort of clear victory that a human never would have considered, because the odds, it was kind of like making your odds worse than better. And the computer was able to sort of.
Yeah. So exactly. The computer is still doing it programmatically in a very mechanical way, but what it's doing is it's looking at the game tree and it's assigning probabilities to each of the branches in the game tree, and it's saying, well, I don't know how this branch is going to ultimately end up, but it looks like it's the highest probability, and that might involve doing, for instance, in chess, a sacrifice of a piece, which seems like in the short term it's bad, but the computer has looked far enough down the game tree that it's like, well, this gives me higher probabilities for a victory, you know, 20 moves ahead. But I don't think that really is a good sign of what really is the distinguishing feature of our species, is that we're sentient and we can recognize ourselves. Self-recognition is something we haven't seen in computers in any sense at all.
Yeah. I mean, do you, would you have a conversation about like something like this with your children at some point, about long-term humanity? And do you think,
yeah. I guess with my kids, I'm much more short term, in that I try to enjoy the present, and I try to enjoy the fact that they're, you know, the most delightful creatures in my life, and that I hope that they have a positive future. The scary thing though is that with humanity right now is that we seem to be in an exponentially growing capacity with our technology, so that technology is becoming more and more powerful, more and more rapidly. And one way to think about this is, I think Ray Kurzweil talked about this a little bit. How far back in history do you have to go before a person from that period would look at your point in history and think that's absolutely astounding? If you go back in the past, really far back in the past, you could go 1,000 years. And a person from, say, the time of Jesus's death to 1,000 years after that, they would say, well, this kind of looks the same. Things haven't changed that much. Maybe the bow and arrow improved a little bit, and maybe a suit of armor is more capable of defending you than it was 1,000 years ago. But now that sort of astonishment has, the time it takes to astonish someone has really shrunk a lot. Like, you could go back to 1980 and teleport, you know, or bring them back in a time, or bring them back to our period of time in a time machine, and they would be absolutely astounded at the kind of things that we can do now, and that with the way people live, and that they have these digital devices that can get any kind of information, any kind of movie, at any moment in time. They would be like, oh my God, how is this possible? And so this is being compressed. So I feel like we're in a period where we have exponential improvements in technology, which makes the likelihood of this asymmetric threat something that we're going to have to deal with in the short term. And I wish that wasn't the case. I wish it wasn't the case that my kids had to live in a world where an asymmetric threat to human society existed, but it potentially could.
Yeah, I'd like to think that, you know, I'm sort of like maybe sometimes short-term pessimistic, but usually very long-term optimistic. I do think we'll figure out the solutions to our problems. I think humanity is has quite amount of an ingenuity and usually kind of figures these things out. I wonder if there's any other hurdles besides maybe multi-planetary travel and ability that is really maybe preventing us from going through if the great filter's in front of us. Is there sort of anything else you think that we would need in our toolkit? And I do wonder...
Yeah, I mean...
If there were other life forms and they could either... We did mention the pessimistic side that maybe they would seed technology or policy or politics in a way to design for our demise, but maybe they gave us Bitcoin to get through the great filter. You know,
Satoshi was actually an alien.
Yeah, maybe they want us to join them, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are other environmental threats you can imagine as well. Like, it's entirely possible that we hit by an asteroid which wipes out every form of life on Earth. Which is one of the reasons why it's so important that we become multiplanetary. As soon as we're multiplanetary, the probability of one of those kind of black swan events wiping out the human species is much, much lower. So if nothing else, we should be trying to get on another planet to avoid the fact that we could get hit by an asteroid. But most people, the scary thing about this is most people are so short-term focused. It's very hard, given... our evolution, to think in the time span of even a century. Most people think in the time span of at most a couple of years. They don't think beyond their own generation or beyond their child's generation. And it's actually harder to do that now because it's harder to imagine what the future will be like. What will the future be like for my great-grandchildren? I have no idea. If you lived in the year 1000, you could probably, you know, imagine what it would be like for your great grandchildren because the rate of change was so slow. So we just don't know how human society is going to evolve and whether that direction will be positive and optimistic, whether it'll be, you know, scary and we'll wipe ourselves out.
Yeah. My final question to you is, do you like the word hyper-Bitcoinization? Do you think that's something that might happen? And what would be your definition of that? I kind of think of very simple terms. It's just Bitcoin would be the universal unit of account.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I think it's a fun word. It was invented by Daniel Krawiz in an article, I think in 2014. Is part of the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, him and Pierre Rochard and Michael Goldstein. And they were just kids in college and they were great. They were really creative and they wrote a bunch of really cool articles. And he sort of hijacked the word hyperinflation and turned it into hyper-Bitcoinization. Hyperinflation is a very bad thing for society. It's a collapse of the division of labor and a breakdown of society into barter and extreme poverty and all of those things. Hyper-Bitcoinization is a very positive event. It's the adoption of a superior form of money, which is the foundation for all trade and savings in society, which allows all sorts of, you know, great things to happen. So I like the word. I think I would define, I really like your definition. I think it's a nice, simple definition. I would define it as when I go to the grocery store, the price of bread is denominated in Satoshis. I see the price in Bitcoin terms. Then I would know we live in a hyper-Bitcoinized world.
Yeah, I think that's also maybe the elimination of volatility. One Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. You're speaking at Bitcoin 2022. Very excited. And that was recently announced. Yeah. What is the message on your profile?
What should I talk about? Should I talk about whether the world is going to end?
Maybe. I thought that was fascinating stuff. We'll see. I don't even know how the format is. Are you going to be on a panel? Are you going to be speaking by yourself? I'm not sure.
I think I'm speaking by myself. So, you know, that'll be the first time and I'll be excited to, get up in front of an audience and probably give them the bullish case for Bitcoin. I imagine that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
But you asked, I think, about my profile.
Yeah, the Latin.
Is it my Twitter profile?
Yeah.
Tune quede malis, sed contra ordentio ito. It's a passage from Virgil's Aeneid, which is the great Roman epic written by Virgil during the time of Augustus. And it means, do not give in to misfortune, or do not give in to evil, proceed ever more boldly against it.
Nice. That's awesome. I can't tell you how fantastic this was. It was epic. Always great to catch up with you. Hope to get it again soon, maybe right before the conference. Tell everyone again where they could find you and the book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. That's where I you know, tweet out my thoughts when I have a little bit of time. So I'm real_VJ. So that's REAL_VIJAY. And you can find my book, you know, in bookstores. Probably Amazon is the place most people find it. You can go to Amazon and search for The Bullish Case for Bitcoin and get yourself a copy. I really appreciate everyone's support.
Awesome, man. This has been so great. Thank you so much, VJ.
Thanks, Sid.
VJ Boyapati on Multimillennial Projects, The Fermi Paradox, and The Great Filter, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this episode was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. If you want to see what it's all about and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Bitcoin 2022 will be held on Miami Beach from April 6th to April 9th of next year, and you can use code Bitcoin Matrix at checkout to get a 10% discount. All tickets are transferable and 100% refundable if you are unable to travel due to COVID restrictions. Finally, thank you for listening. If you dig the Bitcoin Matrix, subscribe, rate, write a 5-star review, and share with your friends and family. There's a bunch of upcoming shows that you don't want to miss out, including conversations with CJ Wilson, Mind Over Matter, Laser Huddle, and Alex Gladstein. Stack Sats, stay humble and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.